And the reaper will come for us all.
Hey, Samantha, where can they find us on the social medias?
I am so glad you asked. They can find us on Facebook and Instagram at Reaper Tales Podcast and on TikTok at reaper.tales.podc. Not pod, just podc.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. And you can email us at reapergals@reapertales.com. I'm always looking at it. So if you're one of the ones that emails me on a regular basis, you know that. I do respond almost in real time, unless like
almost.
I'm on vacation or like I'm bed rotting, but that's a different thing. So email us at reapergals, G-A-L-S, at reapertales.com. Email me to tell me that I look pretty. Email me to tell me I'm doing a good job and to send us your show suggestions and anything else that you want us to cover or anything like that. So, yeah.
And please remember to like, rate, review, subscribe, all the things you lovely listeners know what to do anyway on any of the listening platforms that you use. As per usual, you get bonus points if you do it on platforms you don't listen to us on, but you give us a nice little review. And worded reviews will get special shout outs. So if you are so inclined to do so, please do us a favor. Makes it a little easier for people to find us. And if you don't
Thanks.
Want to be listed out, by the way, on the worded reviews, it's too bad. We're still going to give you a shout out.
Yeah. Yeah. Even if you say we smell like boogers or something like that. Okay. Thanks.
Rude.
Hello, I'm Montana.
And I'm Samantha.
And you're listening to
Reaper Tales.
And today, we're going to talk about conspiracies. But before we get started, Samantha, what are we drinking?
We are drinking the Deception cocktail, or at least some of us are sort of drinking. But this one is going to be 1.5 ounces of gin, 1/2 ounce of cherry liqueur or maraschino liqueur, which is basically cherry liqueur, 1/2 ounce of mezcal, or tequila. I prefer tequila. 1 twist of a lemon peel. You're going to shake on ice, strain into a chilled martini glass or, you know, glass of your choice, and then garnish with the lemon peel. I am not drinking that. But Montana, how did you adjust it? Because we all know you did not follow directions.
Well, I didn't want to drink. And we've gotten requests to do mocktails in conjunction with our actual cocktails. So I did a mocktail. I did Sprite Zero or whatever, the maraschino cherry juice, some lemon juice, and then I had juniper bitters, which I added, which is supposed to
gin,
mimic
for the gin.
Gin. I didn't have a substitute for tequila, but that's fine because I don't really like tequila anyway. So yeah, I did all of that the same way and then just put it in my little glass that Samantha got me.
Oh, I remember getting you that.
Cheers.
So, cheers. I'm drinking cold brew.
I'm drinking water. I can't. Cheers. It's bad luck.
Because some of us did not get great sleep last night. So, coffee to boost my morale or whatever. Give me a will to live. I don't know.
You're doing great.
Anyway, so now that we're through with that, Montana, I believe it's your turn to go first.
I am. And today, I'm going to be covering an age-old question. Are birds actually real?
For some people. I've never wondered this question. Okay, let's go with it.
I know what you're thinking. Montana, of course, birds are real. But it's me.
No, actually what
you.
I was thinking is, of course you would cover this, are birds real? Because there are quite a few that you absolutely positively hate, which I love sending you like reels of, but.
You're mean.
Proceed.
It's mean. It's really mean.
It's only because I love you.
It's me. And I'm telling you that the government is lying to us about birds. Definitely nothing else.
Thank you for specifying.
So around 2017, 2019 time period, I don't know the exact dates of this, but the conspiracy of birds being government drones began to make waves on Twitter and Instagram and Facebook. hundreds of thousands of followers popped up in what seemed like overnight. It was bizarre. And the movement only grew after CIA documents were leaked to the public about these surveillance drones. Once the CIA became involved in the conspiracy theory, it took no time at all to figure out the timeline of events. And it will come as no surprise that it involves the assassination of John F. Kennedy. Oh, man, I can't take this seriously sometimes.
Well, I started thinking about it. I'm like, wait a second. Why does this sound so familiar? You do know that that's mentioned in the Hunger Games, that they used the Mockingjay or the Jabberjays for surveillance. And that came out first. Just saying.
No, I know. And like, we all know that allegedly the CIA assassinated JFK. Allegedly. Do not come after me, CIA. All you will find on my search history is images of birds and videos of people attacking geese back when they attack them. That's all you're going to find.
And should corn be called corn on the cob or corn?
We're not getting into that. The one thing we don't really know about the assassination of JFK is the why, obviously, or who did it, you know, whatever. But the big question here is, why was he assassinated? But I'm here today to tell you the why. And it's birds. You see, the CIA wanted to release a robot called the Turkey X-500. It was developed by sequestered Boeing engineers in Area 51.
I had no idea Boeing had this division. Good to know.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. The robot was to be used to kill all birds. Every single one of them. So they could be replaced by surveillance drones that would spy on the population. But JFK wasn't about that life. So he had to go.
This all sounds very plausible.
Yes. Over the course of 12 years, the CIA took out 12 billion feathered fugitives. They used specially altered B-52 bombers stocked with poison to achieve their goal of a featherless populace. And by 1971, all birds were replaced by drones.
I feel like there would be an easier way to do this.
Yeah.
But okay. That also wouldn't negatively impact the environment as much. But okay.
You're thinking with logic, and you need to think with your soul. Okay.
Sorry, I'm a logical being.
These drones recharge by attaching their ports to power lines. So when you pass by a power line, it has a bunch of birds sitting on it, they're recharging. Those drones are recharging.
I mean, I always thought that anyway.
Mm-hmm. It makes sense. The bird poop on your car that pisses you off, it's actually a liquid tracker, so that they can track you. The reason you haven't seen any baby pigeons in decades, that's because when the drones are created, they're created as full adult pigeons and then released from the factory.
But only pigeons?
Yes. No.
Okay.
All birds. I don't know.
I beg to differ. We saw some baby birds.
They're drones.
Saying, oh, those are the ones that went... Those are the ones that went rogue, like in the Hunger Games, where you had mockingjays.
Must
they
be.
They found one of the birds that was still alive.
This movement has gained so much traction that in 2021, supporters held a demonstration outside of the Twitter headquarters in San Francisco, demanding that the company change the bird logo. So what's actually happening here? Honestly, when I first heard about this conspiracy, I always knew, like, I wanted to cover it on the podcast, but I didn't know anything about it outside of the basic birds aren't real and they're drones. To understand the movement, we have to talk about the creator of it, and that's Peter McIndo. McIndo? Yeah. I never know how to say his last name. It's McIndoe. McIndo. whatever. Gonna call him Peter. Peter grew up in a very conservative rural area in Arkansas. In early 2017, he was studying psychology at the University of Arkansas. And during this time, he went to visit a friend or a group of friends in Memphis, Tennessee. This was right after Donald Trump was elected. And if you remember that time, there were women's marches globally. Sam, you and I actually attended one in Birmingham. A quote from an interview with Peter says, quote, "This was right after Donald Trump was elected and things were really tense. I remember people walking around saying they felt as if they were in a movie. Things felt so unstable." Peter had noticed counter protesters who were older, bigger white men during these demonstrations. Quote, "They were clear aggravators. They were encroaching on something that was not their event. They had no business being there. It felt like chaos because the world felt like chaos." So Peter made his own poster and he went and joined the counter protesters. Quote, "It's not like I sat down and thought, I'm going to make a satire. I just thought, I should write a sign that has nothing to do with what's going on. An absurdist statement to bring to the equation."
I kind of like this guy just for that reason.
Mm-hmm. So he wrote, "Birds aren't real." As he stood with the counter protesters and they asked what his sign meant, he improvised. He said he was part of a movement that had been around for 50 years and was originally started to save American birds, but had failed. The deep state had destroyed them all and replaced them with surveillance drones. Every bird
you know,
this
you sounds like you. This
it
sounds
sound
like something
like
you would come up with.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. I think
it also sounds like something you would do.
Oh, man. I'm glad you said that because I didn't want to say it about myself, but yeah.
This is like your spirit animals.
Mm-hmm. "Every bird you see is actually a tiny feathered robot watching you." After someone posted a video on Facebook that filmed this entire situation, the movement went viral. Some claim it isn't a movement, like in MSNBC, that called it a, quote, "mass coping mechanism for Gen Z." It's an odd thing to fully describe, because while the conspiracy is realistic enough for theorists to believe, it's also satirical enough that younger generations recognize it for what it actually is. The younger generations grabbed onto this movement and really took off with it. There were videos of kids at like football games and school functions chanting "birds aren't real" all over the internet during this time. What started as a way to poke fun at counter protesters turned into something that was kind of thought provoking. I like this quote from an article by The Guardian. It's a vivid dramatization of how divisive conspiracy theories are. People who believe them live in another world, where any wild theory flies and even the most fleeting attempt to fact-check it or test it against logic, if birds have been destroyed, who's eating all the worms, marks you out as a brainwashed liberal. People who don't believe them cannot think themselves into the headspace of those who do. Then along comes a guy with a sign, and maybe he's not bridging this implacable divide, but he's certainly disrupting it. Which, yeah.
I mean, if you think about it, really, I mean, in general for conspiracy theories, right? It's thought provoking. It's worth thinking about and saying, well, but what if? Because sometimes those really crazy ideas do end up making a lot of sense. And it's like, okay, I can actually see where this thought, how you reached from A to Z, that actually kind of makes sense. And then finding plot holes and then having somebody else talk about it and say, but what about this? I mean, it encourages conversation and sometimes things can be uncovered. For instance, are aliens real?
Are aliens real? Yeah.
So I can see where they're going with that. But also even in satire, though, you can sometimes find some truth nuggets in there that it's like, oh, but what about if that was the case? So, yeah, I can see it. I can see how somebody would not intentionally do this, but it got enough people thinking that it then suddenly blew up way out of proportion or way out of what he originally intended.
Yeah, for sure. And it's also, it was an interesting time for it to come about, truly, because if you remember, like back then, obviously the Trump era, we had a bunch of talk about things such as, or a bunch of rhetoric about that's fake news, like that, you know, fake news was a big thing. You had Truth Social starting to pop up, and you had things like conspiracy theories that were really damaging and harmful, like Pizzagate. And if you're not aware of Pizzagate, like that's not something we would ever cover because it was a horrific conspiracy theory and it harmed a lot of people. But it was basically Democrats are trafficking children in pizza joints. Like it was outrageous. So you had a lot of like this kind of thought process in the vein of it could be true. It seems almost plausible. And then you have people who are so bent and determined on believing their own narrative, their own belief system.
Their own agenda.
Yeah. And their minds are softened to the fact that we've been lied to our entire lives. So this has to be true. Like it, you know, every wild theory that's out there has to be true, especially if it benefits the narrative and my own personal agenda. And that's damaging. If you're not sitting down and you're not thinking about things in a logical way, and you're saying, okay, XYZ is being said. When you look at something, you want to look at both sides of it. What supports this and what doesn't support this? It's typically what I do when I'm researching anything. I will search for something that adds to it. And then I will search, literally just type in, what's the opposite of this? You know, yada, yada, yada. But if you're not doing that, you're only going to be fed things that you truly believe. And that's not a good direction to go in. So I thought like this was like a really kind of, while it was a mistake in the beginning, it's a really kind of interesting way to handle this situation that's gotten out of hand, truly. And then, you know, you have somebody who gets elected who is saying everything is fake if it doesn't support my agenda. So it just feeds into this whatever. Oh, anyway, off my podium there. Although, quote, birds aren't real, was very quickly picked up as a chant, getting the movement to snowball did take some work, Peter told this interviewer. Quote, we set up the Bird Brigade, our boots on the ground activism network led by Claire Cronus. That was the first step to building a structured movement, getting it from Memphis to the rest of the U.S., getting people to put up flyers that I designed very poorly in Photoshop, which works for the conspiracy theory aesthetic. They made up facts, fake secretly leaked CIA documents, and made videos. Quote, we created a world with laws and evidence and took out billboard adverts, which people posted on Instagram as selfie backdrops. Quote, if you put something absurd into the world, people are trying to present themselves as irreverent or funny. So that really spread the message. Quote.
Well, yeah, you're getting both sides of the equation, right? Like you had mentioned, you have the people that know this is satire and find it hilarious and are sharing it. And they're sharing it for both sides as well. They're sharing it for those of their friends that they know are going to find it as satire and funny. And for those of their audience that are actually going to be like, wait, what? This is brand new. I've never heard of this. And then like get really interested in the whole thing. So, yeah. I mean, I can see how this would easily go viral because it goes for both sides. Because it's just enough that it's obviously satire for those of us that would see it as such. But it's also just enough plausibility there that conspiracy theorists would really grab onto that and run with it.
Yeah, I agree. And I think that was kind of like push to continue it, that
but
idea.
It's so funny because just to think of this guy, just like, I just wanted to make fun of these people. And I'm just going to make the most ridiculous sign I can think of that has nothing to do with anything. And then it goes crazy and he's like, okay, I'll run with this. Sure. Why not?
I'll run with it. And it wasn't even like, my thought was like, it wasn't even, he made this sign to make fun of them. He made, in my mind, it was, he made this sign to show how ridiculous it was that they were even there, because what was being protested had nothing to do with them.
Exactly.
It was,
that's what I'm saying. Like, that was not even, it had nothing, he had no agenda there, to be perfectly honest, that had anything to do with what he did, which is why he did it that way. And then it just blew up into this completely other thing that I guarantee he had no,
absolutely no
idea, inkling that this was ever going to happen.
Oh man, what a wild thing to do.
You should be careful about the stories you come up with and share on TikTok, Montana, because this could happen to you. Some of those stories that you come up with.
I do come up with some really weird stories on there, but everything I say on there is actually true. So they're not, it's not weird stuff. It's like, I'm actually telling you the truth. Meanwhile, quote, real conspiracy theorists will approach me like I'm their brother, like I'm part of their team. They will start spouting hateful rhetoric and racist ideas because they feel as if I'm a safe place, unquote. In describing the movement, he gets towards perhaps the closest definition of what is happening. Quote, it is a collective role-playing experiment. There is true community found through this. It breaks down political barriers. We have taken pictures of a car parked at a Birds Aren't Real rally, and there are people who will show up with U.S. flags on their car, Republican, patriotic displays, and a car right next to them with Bernie Sanders stickers. Quote, I was a Bernie guy myself. You see these people marching together, unified. Peter has a long game with Birds Aren't Real. Quote, I think it has the potential to be a creative collective for a long time. I would love Birds Aren't Real to continue to be a space to process the badness. I don't think the madness is going to necessarily end. I think the lunacy is going to become more intense. So I watched like a TED talk he did as well. And this was recent. And it was really well done and thought-provoking. And I'll link it in the show notes so anybody can go watch it. But the gist was that in bringing in actual dangerous conspiracy theorists and allowing them a safe space to unlearn and unpack these harmful theories and beliefs, it can lead to a more informed and involved society. Which, yeah, truly. There's also like a website for Birds Aren't Real. And if you go to it, and it's going to be in the show notes, if you go to it, it looks like a conspiracy theorist website, you know, like the really bad graphics, it's kind of laggy and all of that
stuff.
Does
it look like old MySpace pages?
Yeah, it does. But it's in the vein of that, but it's well done. You know, you can tell like it's like a fake whatever. And he also has a, there is a book that he wrote for Birds Aren't Real. And I actually do have it. It's pretty great. So go and read that if you want. But it's on his website. You can get it on his website. So yeah, that's what Birds Aren't Real actually is.
Wow. Okay. So I didn't know any of that part. That was actually a lot more thought-provoking than I thought it would be.
I know, same. I just wasn't expecting that.
There was a little bit more purpose behind it than I anticipated.
Mm-hmm. I'm so glad I did it. Because I thought like, oh, it's going to be funny. It's going to be kooky. It's blah, blah, blah. But no, I learned a lot more. And it softened me to the idea that people who are so staunchly in that mindset of these conspiracy theories are real, Hillary Clinton eats babies, you know, can actually change their mind. And it's not that I want them to necessarily change their mind about conspiracies, but to change their behavior and motivations behind believing that kind of stuff. And that's just like my opinion.
No, it makes sense. I mean, It's one thing to take an idea and run with it and see how far you can go and what information you can find. It's another to only look up information that confirms or supports that theory, because that's not how research is done, despite what what news stations would have you believe nowadays.
Yeah, and it's dangerous. You know, if something's going to be harmful to anyone or anything, I don't think that you need to give it legs so that it can run.
Or wings so it can fly.
Exactly. That was a good one. Should have thought of that. Didn't.
I totally thought you were waiting on that, but okay.
Oh, what? No, I was trying to be deep and,
oh,
you know, whatever.
Sorry, I ruined it.
No, you made it perfect. Oh, well, man.
Good job. That was fascinating. And it kind of makes me want to get that book and read it and see what it's all about.
They also have lots of merch on their website. It says, if it flies, it spies. And it has like how they charge on the wires. It's really cool. I like it.
I do want to get one of the shirts for sure. If it flies, it spies. That is hilarious. Oh, man.
Well, good job. I guess it's my turn. Are you ready to hear about my conspiracy theories?
Yes, as long as we all agree up top, what's her face is a turd butt, and we don't support her.
Yes.
The author.
The writer.
What's her name?
J.K. Rowling.
Okay, yeah.
This is going to be about Harry Potter conspiracy theories, by the way, ladies and gentlemen. When we decided to cover conspiracy theories, I immediately wanted to do ones on Harry Potter because I have read some crazy theories, but others were actually kind of fascinating and thought-provoking. I also find conspiracy theories on books that have been written, fictional or otherwise, very fascinating as well. And I honestly am more into that than I am into some of the other conspiracy theories about the real world anyway. So, I mean, I think it's amazing how people can just like read books and then, because I mean, I read books and I think somewhat outside of the book of what the book gives you, but these people are the way that the people who have come up with these theories, it makes sense, but my brain never goes in that direction. So I find that fascinating that people can come up with like the wiki fandoms or whatever, where they actually get all of these backstories for these characters that are never actually really written about, and they can come up with all of these other things, and it's just really fascinating. So I've kind of wanted to cover some of these and do some research on more. So I can't wait to see what you think about some of these theories, either one of you actually. And there's some hidden gems, and maybe you'll have some other thoughts, but I'm just hoping basically it'll make you at least say, but there's probably going to be ones where you're going to be like, yeah, okay, no, absolutely not. And then there's going to be other ones where you're going to go, oh my gosh, that makes perfect sense, because I definitely had moments like that when I was going through these.
It's going to be a hit or miss. I haven't read Harry Potter since I was in high school.
A lot of this can follow with the movies. A lot of this, the movies kind of cover a good bit of it. There are a few topics where you really would need to read the books to kind of get some of it. That being said, if you haven't read the books, you haven't watched the movies, and you don't want any spoilers, I'm not going to say spoiler, because these have been out for 17 to 27 years between the movie series and the book series. So you can choose to miss the rest of this episode if you don't want to be spoiled. But also, seriously, read the books and watch the movies, because it's been a while.
But get them secondhand or at the library.
So you can skip over this part if necessary. There you go. Yeah, absolutely. And they are very good books. They do have good storylines. They do teach. It does have kind of an underlying theme. And, you know, there are lessons to be learned from it. It's not all about magic. I wasn't allowed to read the books when I was a kid because it's all about magic and that's of the devil. We're not even going to get into that. But yes, it is about magic, but it's a fantasy world. Just go with it. It's okay. Pretend things are okay.
If you can't read something.
I mean, yeah. Lord of the Rings has a wizard in it, but that one was okay. I don't know.
If you're told you can't read things because they're magic, you need to throw it back on the person who says it And this is just anything in life. And you need to say, how do you think I became who I am? Because if you think this was organic, you've lost your mind. This is magic. I am magic.
You're not wrong. All right. Our first theory is probably not super surprising, and it's also the most depressing. So I wanted to go ahead and get it out of the way. Harry hallucinated the entire series.
I can believe
the
that.
The idea here is that Harry was driven mad by the mistreatment of his aunt and uncle through the abuse and starvation and being stuck in the cabinet under the stairs his whole life. He made up an entirely different world where he was special and had parents who loved him but were killed by an evil madman. While this is arguably the most depressing theory of the ones I'll go over, it also makes a lot of sense. It's definitely something that would be easy to imagine, as his aunt and uncle were absolutely terrible to him. And our brains find ways to deal with situations we're forced to endure sometimes. Mm-hmm. The idea that Harry would create a whole other world to hide away in isn't that crazy of an idea, is all I'm saying.
No, not at all. I actually like that one.
It's kind of depressing, though, because none of it actually happened. And he's just still in that cupboard and stuck living with that aunt and uncle. Like, that's kind of depressing.
Yeah, but it makes me feel better about the fact that I didn't get a Hogwarts letter. So.
Oh, that's fair. He made up the whole thing. Okay. It doesn't. I can get behind that. That's fair. All right. So next up, the Dursleys were so evil and terrible to Harry because he himself was a Horcrux. This one really blew my mind, so follow along. Those that have read the series or watched the movies know that the Horcruxes had a terrible impact on those that had them. Harry, Ronald, and Hermione all acted worse after very little time with the one that they had while they were trying to figure out how to destroy it. If that's the case, and we know Harry was the last one, then it's very possible that the Dursleys were affected by him himself. It also explains why they seem to get worse and worse as the books and movies went on. The pitfall of this one is that he didn't seem to affect anyone else that he spent a lot of time with in the series. Those he spent time with at school and later when he lived with the Weasleys. Now, maybe that's because they were wizards and they weren't affected as much as the Muggles would have been. Also, Harry spent constant time with the Dursleys, whereas he spent time with many people at school, not just one or two people, like all the time. So maybe that could have made a difference as well. So what are your thoughts on that one?
I mean, I can see it, but I don't like it. I can see that that would be a possibility, but I also don't like that theory because it gives kind of an excuse and justification to the abuse he suffered. So I'm gonna
and so here's the other part of that. Maybe they were not bad, but they weren't great people to begin with, and so that only highlighted and increased the amount of evil that they had inside of themselves. And maybe why that was actually another kind of like branch off of that theory, was they already had some of that in them, whereas the other people he was around did not. So that only increased and encouraged that aspect of their psyche or who they were.
I mean, yeah, when I think about the Dursleys, and maybe this is the case and it just enhanced it, but when I think about the Dursleys, it's that they are their characters, whatever, but they're created in the vein of like, your everyday person who just doesn't like anything that they don't have. They're envious of it. And so they lash out because they don't have like the emotional maturity to, you know, inwardly look at themselves. So it's like this, I don't know, idea of what the average, I guess, UK person, British person, even the American person is. So when it talks about them, it's always, they're always wanting more, consuming more, having the best, talking about needing the best. And then you have this one person in your life who has something that you will never have. And they hate that.
Like talent.
Like magic, you know? So to me, I always thought about them as like, that is how an actual person probably who didn't have emotional maturity would react, especially if they're those keeping up with the Joneses type people.
Yeah. And also remember that she was his mother's sister and she was already pretty awful to his mother when they were growing up. So, and had also the books kind of highlighted a little bit more, I think, but also very much held it against his mother because she was so special and would try to bully that aspect and make it into, and that is kind of how human beings do, some people do that are immature, is those things that are special, you find those things and that's what you bully somebody for so that they no longer find that as a positive, but they then feel self-conscious about it and don't want it anymore. So that way it somehow is supposed to make you feel better. But yeah, that's a good point. All right. So the third theory is that Crookshanks, Hermione's cat, was actually Lily Potter. This one is interesting, but I don't find it likely. The reasoning is that she chased Scabbers whenever possible, who we knew later on was Peter Pettigrew, and attempted to kill him. Hard not to imagine a cat doing that with a rat in general, but okay. It was also a female orange tabby with green eyes, which was how Lily was described. But also an orange cat with green eyes, again, is not that unusual. So, thoughts on that theory?
Again, I can see it, but she died. And we know she died. And the reason I'm so staunch about that is because the whole reason that Harry was protected from Voldemort was because his mother died for him. So, ex-nay. I mean, it's a cool theory. It's a neat theory. And I would have believed it more had it been somebody else that could have been the cat.
Yeah.
But no, she died. She died. The whole thing behind it is she died to save him.
And that was a part of the spell that she cast, right? She kind of had to die in order for it to work.
Right. So no. I mean, good theory, but no.
Yeah, I found it interesting, but not plausible. The next one was completely new to me and actually made me pause for a second, but still don't really believe this one either. Hermione actually is Harry's secret sister and was given up to a Muggle family, possibly for her protection. The relationship between them is one reason. They always seem to get along, and there wasn't a romance between them whatsoever, though I do seem to remember her kissing him once, which is giving weird Star Wars, Luke Skywalker, and Leia vibes.
Flowers in the attic.
We're not even going to go there. Gross. But they sometimes could finish each other's sentences like the Weasley twins did in the books. And the fact that she seemed to know way too much about the wizarding world if she came from a Muggle family. She was also that Muggle family's only child, at least the only wizard in that family. And this one could have some merit, I guess, in theory, though the fact that they were the same age makes it less so to me because they would have to have been twins. And if that was the case, why would they have given up Hermione for her protection and not Harry when they knew what the prophecy was that he was going to be the one that was going to be in the most danger? Or maybe they felt like Hermione would be less looked for because of that. I don't know. But this one I feel a little less likely, but it is kind of an interesting thought, I guess.
Yeah.
Because I did always wonder how she knew so much about the wizarding world when she'd only been involved in it as long as Harry, really, in theory, because they all get the invitation at the same time.
I have a couple of points to make on this one. Number one, they had to be siblings because it seemed they got along so well. Has anybody ever had a fucking sibling? Like, seriously? Mine chased me with a knife at one point.
We didn't get along until we became adults.
No. No. If you're getting along that well with your sibling, there's something wrong with you. That's all I'm saying.
Or you just don't know your siblings.
Right. Number two, I think the reason that Hermione really knew a lot about the wizarding world was because that was just who she was as a person. She had to know everything. She had to learn everything, consume everything. So she had, because she had to be knowledgeable on everything. So that kind of like, it didn't, it wasn't like a weird concept for me to go, you know, she's a muggle. She hasn't known anything about this, but girl would probably figure everything out in like 10 minutes anyways. So, yeah. And I just don't get why his parents would give her up. Like, I get kind of like the justification, like, let's protect the one that has nothing to do with this. But at the same time, they didn't know for sure if Harry was the one. It could have been Harry or Neville at that time.
I'll go into that one.
So it just seems like a drastic thing on a like a maybe situation to give up an entire baby and not both of them.
Yeah.
But cool theory, bro.
Same. All right, so this one was I had never heard. J.K. Rowling is actually Rita Skeeter. From Time.com, quote, here's a series of leading questions about everyone's favorite unregistered among
Animagus.
Whatever. What if Rita Skeeter fled the Wizarding World after the Battle of Hogwarts? What if she was exiled for being such a horrible journalist? And what if she just decided to write under a pseudonym like someone else we know? What if her topic of choice was the very Wizarding World that rejected her? And what if she wrote a 7-part series about a boy wizard that concludes with the very battle she left after? Some people very much believe this could be possible. Again, this is assuming the Wizarding World is real.
Yeah. Yeah. I would think so if the Wizarding World was real. Do I think there's magic in the world? 100%. Do I think it's that magic? No.
Same.
I don't know. It's hard for me to like get a grip on that because Rita Skeeter
was out to make some money. So let's put that together real quick.
Yeah. If Rita Skeeter, like if this was a likely situation, if it could happen, there's two different like writing styles here. Rita Skeeter did anything to get like the most inflammatory information on somebody so that she could write about it.
Type writing.
Yeah. And Harry Potter, like the whole series it's a novel. So, and I'm not saying like a columnist can't write a novel. I'm simply saying like there's two very different, even though J.K. Rowling is the one that wrote Rita Skeeter, I don't think it would go in reverse, if that makes sense.
Yep. I like that you took this seriously and gave a real serious answer.
Well, I'm trying, okay?
No, I really like it. I like the answer. Okay, so number 6, Draco Malfoy is actually a werewolf. So there is a whole website for this theory, and it is DracoMalfoyIsAWerewolf.com. And from the site, I'm going to quote all of it just because it's really good, but by all means, go to the site. It's actually pretty interesting. Quote, we've gone back through the 6th and the 7th books and compiled some of the most convincing evidence below. Draco is not a Death Eater. At the beginning of the 6th book, when Harry is hiding in Borgin and Burks, Draco threatens Borgin and shows him something on his arm. Harry thinks the thing on Draco's arm is a death mark or is a dark mark, but we never actually see it. Harry always immediately assumes things, and they turn out to be false anyway in the books. We all know that. So that's very likely that he thought that's what it was, but didn't actually get a good look at it. If Harry wakes up in the middle of the night months later, it's usually right. Or if he talks about it with Hermione and Hermione gets it, then it's right. Hermione doesn't think Draco is a Death Eater, so he probably isn't. Another reason Draco probably doesn't have a dark mark is that at the end of the 6th book, there is a barrier to the astronomy tower that you can only pass through if you have the dark mark. This barrier goes up immediately after Draco goes up to the tower and comes down just before he goes down. Additionally, Draco is never threatened as a Death Eater, and there is no reason for Voldemort to give Draco a dark mark. So what is he? One ongoing arc in the 6th book is that Draco is sickly and stressed out. This is supposedly because of his quest, but Rowling does this misdirection a lot. Fenrir Greyback is introduced as a character who specifically punishes people who've messed up by biting their children. Remus Lupin is explicitly mentioned as an example of this. Why set this up if not to use it later? Relatedly, Lucius's demonstrated punishments do not seem severe enough for his transgressions at the end of the fifth book, by the standards we are supposed to expect from Voldemort by this point in the series, which I didn't think about until I read that. Because Lucius probably would have been killed if he treated him the way he treated everybody else, but he didn't. It's also important to keep in mind that Lucius also mishandled Riddle's diary, resulting in the destruction of 1/7 of Voldemort's soul. It's likely that Lucius's additional punishment was unspeakably terrible. Voldemort says, quote, "Maybe you can babysit the cubs," end quote, to Draco when the Death Eaters find out that Remus and Tonks are having a baby. This is a throwaway if he is not a werewolf. For us, the nail in the coffin is that while showing Borgin the mark on his arm, Draco says that Fenrir Greyback is a close personal friend and he'd hate for him to have to pay a visit. And if the thing on Draco's arm in Borgin and Burks was not a dark mark, which it's not, what else could he have possibly shown Borgin to make him so frightened? Maybe a bite mark, I'm assuming, is the thought process there.
I like this one.
Finally, Rowling has said in an interview that one scene in the third movie, there was a moment that foreshadows something she knew was coming that gave her chills. In that movie, Draco impersonates a werewolf and does a wolf howl. This also works for the arc for the flipping of the Malfoy family, who take care of themselves instead of following Voldemort. It makes more sense for them to throw away decades of servitude if one of them has been turned into a half-blood, making them ideologically incompatible with Voldemort's pure-blood regime. So why hide it? There is precedence for J.K. Rowling revealing only the tip of the iceberg in some of her characterizations. For example, Rowling was originally going to write a whole arc about Dean Thomas's family, but instead she focused on Neville. Additionally, Dumbledore's love of Grindelwald is never addressed during any of the books and was only revealed by J.K. Rowling during a Q&A after all the books had been published. There are likely many other elements of the story that have been left behind the scenes for one reason or another. It may be entirely possible that Draco's reveal was planned for the seventh book, for example, but got cut for pages. One reason this would be really cool: it makes Draco's relationship with Snape even more interesting if Draco was relying on him for Wolfsbane potion, which is what Lupin was using to harness his, or to suppress his werewolf side. So, thoughts. This one I found fascinating.
It would make sense. And like the scenes that you're talking about, I do remember them, but I don't, again, it felt like a throwaway thing. And I never really thought about the fact that the mark was not a whatever for Draco, because it just didn't matter, because you're only focused on like the main characters of this and the fact that he was, you know, very ill and sickly in those last books. It makes sense, especially knowing what Lupin went through. And I just thought, like, the whole thing behind having Fenrir or whatever his name was around was because he did end up biting and changing one of the Weasley brothers at one point, if you remember.
Yeah. Well, no, I don't remember that for the Weasley brothers. I know one of them got... He mentions it in, oh yeah, that's right. He mentions it in The Order of the Phoenix, I think, that he got, he has a scratch marks on his face that he has scars from.
Yeah. So I thought that was the reason that he was around, but I guess he could be around for more than one reason, and it would make sense that it was this, because it doesn't make any sense that Lucius stayed around after everything that he did.
But he does mention multiple times that I feel like, if I remember correctly, and I watched these after, I watched the whole series after I did the research for this, he threatens Draco's life regularly. Mm-hmm. And that's kind of the thing he holds over him. So it would also tie that into it. Like, I've already done one thing and he still has his life in a way. Don't make me completely take it away.
Yeah. And I mean, the Malfoys would want to hide something like that, because anything that makes them lesser, they don't want them to know about. like the public to know about. So it would make sense. I mean, I like that. I like that. I could see it.
But then also think about it. I think the Weasley brother that ended up getting got the one that ended up getting bitten was the one that was staying around the dragons all the time.
Yeah, Bill.
And the Malfoys were all about dragons. Mm-hmm. And that would also have a weird parallel to that aspect too.
Oh, true. Yeah.
Okay. So I think this is totally believable and it could be something that comes out at some point, but that one's one I could actually get behind for sure. But I had never thought about it until I read all of that.
Yeah, true.
All right. So the seventh, Neville Longbottom actually isn't a bad wizard. He was just using the wrong wand. According to the books, Neville used his father's wand to honor him, but at some point the wand breaks and Neville has to get a new wand. For the first time, he gets a wand, which is important as the wand chooses the wizard, and he hasn't had that happen up until this point. Afterwards, his wizarding skills immediately improve. So the argument becomes Neville was actually never a bad wizard. He just didn't have the correct tools.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I
which makes
I
perfect
agree.
Sense.
Yeah, I don't think that's a theory. I think that's just a fact.
Well, it's never explicitly stated, so it's technically a theory.
Well, I mean, and he was a powerful wizard in and of himself.
Mm-hmm.
It was just, and if you are kind
of
like
born
clumsy,
of a very strong family too. His parents were a part of the Order of the Phoenix.
Yeah, and if you are like kind of clumsy, kind of scattered, and you're not using like the correct wand, any mistake that you make is gonna be bigger than what it would be if you weren't that kind of wizard. So yeah, I mean, they bumble him around, they make him look like an idiot. But the only reason he looks like an idiot is because his displays are bigger than what they normally would be, in my mind.
So, yeah.
I'm a fan of Neville.
All right. So now we get to the last one that you started hinting on. Since we're talking about Neville, let's go to the last one. Neville is actually the true chosen one. This one I had definitely heard before and went down a bit of a rabbit hole with the lore. This comes about because the prophecy that Voldemort ultimately follows to hunt down Harry simply says the boy would be born at the end of the seventh month. And both Harry and Neville were both born at that time. As mentioned in the previous point, Neville wasn't a terrible wizard. He just didn't have the correct tools. Once he had his wand, his skills dramatically improved. The other identifying factors were male, check, born to parents who had defied the Dark Lord three times, and both sets of parents were in the Order of the Phoenix, so very likely that they had at least defied him three times. Must be marked by the Dark Lord as an equal. I'll get onto that one in a minute. And will have power the Dark Lord knows not. Not really clear what that exactly means, but I'll kind of go over that one too. There was a Reddit post that I found by Wentworth 1030, and I just basically quoted from this because it was really good because they go through each and every aspect of it. So, born to those who have thrice defied him. Not quite as easy to identify, James and Lily were known to be close to Dumbledore, so their acts of rebellion against Voldemort would be quite obvious. Frank and Alice Longbottom, however, were Aurors. Defying dark wizards covertly and secretly was literally their day job. They could defy the Dark Lord without detection much more easily, and it would have never occurred to someone as short-sighted as Voldemort that more than one couple could defy him. Then you have this. The Dark Lord will mark him as an equal. Voldemort, having set his sights on Harry, accidentally transfers part of his soul into him. This, on the surface, cuts Neville out of the equation, as there's no point in the series where something similar happens to him. However, there are other ways to mark someone as your equal. Neville and Voldemort meet face-to-face once in the series. It's near the climax of the final book. Voldemort treats Neville with surprising praise, at least at first. It's completely unlike how he's treated Harry, who he only shows hostility and contempt towards. Quote, "You show spirit and bravery, and you come of noble stock. You will make a very valuable Death Eater. We need your kind, Neville Longbottom," end quote. Voldemort compliments Neville in a way he hasn't complimented anyone else in the series, including his own Death Eaters. He treats Neville like one of his peers. He marks him as the subject of the prophecy, not with a curse or accidental magic, but with simple, powerful words. Voldemort marks Harry as his enemy, but in this moment, it's Neville who he marks as an equal. Now the part, he will have power the dark lord knows not. So what about this? Are we talking about love, herbology, something else entirely? There is one power demonstrated in the series that both Neville and Harry prove to have. It's the power to summon the Sword of Gryffindor from the Sorting Hat, or as I like to call it, the Power of Gryffindor. The prophecy has positioned Neville and Harry as the worthy Gryffindors to oppose Voldemort, the worthy Slytherin. While both boys possess the power of Gryffindor, it is Neville in the end who uses it to vanquish the Dark Lord. In this situation, to vanquish the Dark Lord doesn't necessarily mean to kill the man known as Voldemort. It may have a deeper meaning than that. Neville does the vanquishing when he uses the sword to destroy Voldemort's final Horcrux, Nagini. At this precise moment, Voldemort is no longer the all-powerful, immortal Dark Lord. He's merely a mortal man, Tom Riddle. Mm-hmm. I think it's also worth mentioning the biblical symbolism of this scene, using a sword shaped like a cross to cut off the head of a snake, often shown to represent evil. Wouldn't this be a fitting visual metaphor for the sentence, "Vanquish the Dark Lord"? Notice that after the destruction of the final Horcrux, Rowling begins to refer to him as Tom Riddle more and more. Also notice that Tom isn't even killed by Harry. He accidentally kills himself. Riddle hit the floor with a mundane finality, his body feeble and shrunken. The white hands empty, the snake-like face vacant and unknowing. Voldemort was dead, killed by his own rebounding curse. Neither can live while the other survives. I admit this line is harder to pin on Voldemort and Neville, but then again, it's never fully explained how this would refer to Voldemort and Harry either. My guess would be that Neville, who has the power of Gryffindor, cannot coexist with Voldemort, who has the power of Slytherin. The same applied to the original Godric Gryffindor and Salazar Slytherin, who eventually discovered that they couldn't coexist at Hogwarts. Gryffindor and Slytherin represent two sides of magic, and magic or the prophecy or even fate has determined that these two opposing ideologies must do battle. So here's my theory. Thanks for reading the long post. Hopefully this doesn't annoy too many people, end quote. So, thoughts? I think they laid it out really well and kind of went through everything.
I always thought that Neville was the chosen one outside of Harry. It's kind of like that you create your own idols situation. Everyone thought it was Harry, so they made Harry the chosen one, when in reality it was Neville. And to kind of like, because Neville's parents were Auras, but they didn't die like Harry's parents did. They were tortured until they were mentally unstable. So he didn't lose.
I think were they still alive in the books, but they were at a hospital, or I forget what it was called.
Yeah. Yeah. And like that, the phrase of neither can live while the other survives. It's an interesting like verbiage to use because it can mean a lot of different things. I mean, you can live and thrive. You can live and survive. And so the idea to me is like, as long as Voldemort is living, you're only like surviving over here. And that's kind of like what Neville was. And he ends up like thriving afterwards. So it's like a counterweight. As long as one is there, the other is never going to be fully kind of on top of it. Because if you look at Harry afterwards, he just becomes a normal dude. And what did Neville do? I don't remember.
I honestly can't remember.
Does he thrive? I don't know. But it's kind of like my thought behind that is like, it would make more sense for that to be the case than it to be Harry, simply because, like, you know, we went through the whole, oh, fake death, blah, 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 in order to eliminate that Horcrux. It was about the Horcrux. That's all Harry was. He was a vessel for this Horcrux for Voldemort. But Neville is actually the one that ends up destroying any visage of what Voldemort could actually be. And while Harry did it in many other cases, it was Neville that did the final one. So I believe that. I've always thought it was Neville.
You can combine this with the other theory that Harry, Hermione, and Ronald, none of them were supposed to be in Gryffindor. Harry was supposed to be in Slytherin. Hermione was supposed to be in Ravenclaw. And Ronald was supposed to be in Hufflepuff, which would mean Neville's the only one that was supposed to be in Gryffindor.
Can you explain that to me? Because I didn't know that. Like, I knew Harry, he was saying, like, not Slytherin, not Slytherin. You know what I mean? Like, in the movie or whatever. But, like, I didn't know about the other two. Can you tell me about
that? Yeah, so there's a whole theory about Gryffindor is one of the only ones where you can choose to go into that house rather than basically being destined. Although it says in there that the Sorting Hat takes what you want into account when it makes the decision. Hermione obviously is Ravenclaw because of how they're supposed to be known for how smart they are and how they think throughout, you know, through everything. So they're supposed to be the smartest. Hufflepuff, they're the kindest. And they're the ones that, I mean, it's just kind of, every time I hear Hufflepuff, all I hear is Jigglypuff from Pokemon. I can't help it. But it's, I mean, they're the softest and the kindest, and that's kind of how they're known. And then Slytherin.
They're whimsical.
Yeah. Slytherin, obviously Harry fit the Slytherin bill. I mean, he could speak in parcel tongue, and there were other things that showed that he should have been in Slytherin. So he didn't want to be in Slytherin and got put in Gryffindor because he just didn't want Slytherin.
Well, and Slytherin was cunning and intelligent, and that was more Harry than anything, because
Gryffindor are known for their courage. That's
courage and things like that. And I don't believe that Harry is courageous. I don't. I think he is cunning.
I think he got really lucky and he had really good people around him that saved his butt on a regular basis.
He fell into success because of the people that were around him. And you're right. He could have fit well into Slytherin. And the Ravenclaw thing with Hermione, but I didn't know the thing about Hufflepuff with Ron because he's a Weasley and they're like so automatically.
He wanted to be in Gryffindor because that's where his twin brothers were in. And I think his older brother was head boys at the time. So he wanted to be in Gryffindor. So again, the Sorting Hat took that into account. And Hermione, I don't really know. I think there was something said in the book at some point when she had the Sorting Hat on, but I think she didn't. She wanted to be in Gryffindor as well. So it was like all three of them actually didn't go to the house they should have been in. They went to Gryffindor because that's where they wanted to be.
Mm-hmm.
And again, this plays that dynamic of Slytherin versus Gryffindor. That is supposed to be kind of the dynamic because it does get mentioned in the book that those two members of the original people that started those houses did do battle because they couldn't coexist. And that's specifically mentioned. So it would make sense that, again, that ties Neville because Neville was in Gryffindor.
Yeah, and Neville was automatically Gryffindor.
So it's just a thought.
Interesting.
It's just interesting, thought-provoking.
And Neville
things.
Is brave. Like, Neville's probably one of the bravest people in Gryffindor because of the things that he does and, like, standing up to his friends. And, like, that takes a lot of courage.
Well, and he stands up to Voldemort in that last battle. He's the one that walks forward. And then he pulls out that sword. And it's like, that's one of my favorite scenes of the whole series is when he's like, yeah, no thanks. Have no desire whatsoever to join you. And just does his own thing.
Fuck you, kick rocks.
Yeah, exactly. And he's the one that walks forward and is, you know, he's the one out of everybody at that school when Voldemort walks up and is basically saying, you guys have lost because I killed Harry. He's like, no, I'm still not going to bow to you.
Mm-hmm.
I'll still fight you.
Yeah.
So, I mean, that's some courage.
Yeah.
And then he asks out Luna at the end. He's like, I got to go find her. I'm crazy about her. I'm like, good grief. It took you long enough.
That was me. I was Luna.
I believe it. It's so funny. In that last movie, she goes, Harry Potter. Like the first time she ever shouts, she goes, Harry Potter, you will stop and listen to me right now. And he's like, turns and looks real quick because she's never spoken like that before.
Oh, man.
So anyway, I took it a different direction just like you did, but in a different direction than you did. But neither one of us did like real conspiracy theories this time.
Well, mine is a conspiracy, for sure. It's just like it's a conspiracy that actually has a beneficial kind of message and agenda in it. So
outside of the actual theory itself.
Yeah. So I want to do conspiracies again, but, you know, we have to be, like I said, we have to be careful what we cover because we don't want to do something that's going to perpetuate harmful thoughts and things like that. So we'll bring another one to you at some point.
Well, this was fun.
It was.
Good job.
Thanks. Good job, you. Good job, Kelsey.
I really enjoyed myself.
Well, that's always the goal.
Yes, it is. Anyways, until next time, we love you. We mean it.
Okay, bye.
The Reaper will come for us all.